It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says there's a lot more overlap between the worlds of religion and science than people might think. First, President Trump delivered his first State of the Union address last night to a joint session of Congress. He pointed toward economic gains over the last year and said that the country is seeing a time of opportunity for everyone.
This, in fact, is our new American moment. There has never been a better time to start living the American dream. So to every citizen watching at home tonight, no matter where you've been or where you've come from, this is your time.
The president went on to call for Congress to pass a new infrastructure plan, overhaul the nation's immigration system, and modernize America's nuclear weapons. We want to know what stood out to you at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with the president that the State of the Union is stronger than it was a year ago? What issue do you think we'll most likely see progress on in the coming year? Was there something you were looking for in the speech that you did not hear? Email ideas@WPR.org or call in at 800-642-1234. Julia Azari is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. She researches the American presidency, political parties, and political rhetoric. Julia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we get to the content of the speech, Julia, people wonder, does the State of the Union matter? Is this something worth tuning into? You wrote a piece on 538 saying, yeah, it is. Tell us about it.
So I think that there's, one of the things I really like about the State of the Union compared with other types of speeches, particularly an Oval Office address, is that you actually do get to see Congress. You get to see Congress reacting and responding, and you see that you kind of are reminded of all the different people that are involved in the national lawmaking process and not just the president making proclamations. I also think the State of the Union, so I admit I was grumbling last night when he went into four pillars at 9 o'clock, an hour into the speech, our time. Yeah, I was ready to go to bed, but I like that it's a longer speech because it gives presidents an opportunity to talk about the themes that tie together their agenda. And, they do this in different ways, and some arguably are more effective than others. And obviously, depending on where people stand, they might have very strong responses in favor or against the content of those themes. But I think that's really important in a democracy is not just a thing about the nitty-gritty of each individual policy issue, but to really think about what's the broader idea and significance of each part of this agenda.
We heard leading up to the speech that President Trump would push for bipartisanship. Here's a listen to a little bit of his call for that near the beginning of the address.
But it is not enough to come together only in times of tragedy. Tonight, I call upon all of us to set aside our differences, to seek out common ground, and to summon the unity we need to deliver for the people.
So in his policy parts of his speech and the symbolic parts of the speech, did you hear the president continue that theme?
So are you talking about the
Of bipartisanship working together, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. I've been reading some of the reactions the next day, and there seems to be these, two very different reactions to the domestic policy substance. One suggests that there are a number of things on the table for Democrats to like, including an infrastructure bill. And then there's the other perspective that essentially says, regardless of what's being offered here, the tension of the moment is not going to allow for a lot of bipartisanship, and the kinds of symbolic language that Trump used throughout the speech is really going to turn off Democratic voters. And then if that's the case, then Democratic lawmakers don't have a lot of incentive to cooperate with the president.
And the president talked about good news in the economy over the last year, unemployment down, stock market up, African-American and Hispanic-American unemployment at record lows. The argument since then seems to be how much credit does President Trump get to take versus continuing past trends? How do you split that difference?
I guess the way I split that difference is that when it comes to election time, the president is going to take responsibility for the current state of the economy, regardless of how much it may have been a group effort, which is almost always, right? the structural factors in the economy that lead to any particular set of outcomes are very longstanding. But that's, you know, when it comes to be 2020, if the economy's good, then Trump will get credit for that. And if it's not good, then he'll be blamed. And I think, a version of that is also in effect in 2018. I will also say, though, this is important. People in political science and in data journalism, people who pay attention to numbers and to trends, have noted that Trump is much less popular. His approval ratings are much lower than you would expect, given the quality of the economy.
And why is that? Just the same things we've been talking about since the election?
I think that seems like the most obvious explanation, that we have a president who, if you look at his path to the presidency, and it's interesting to me that we can't have a conversation about Trump without it ultimately tying back to the election very quickly. This is a president who had a controversial path to the nomination and then a very divisive and intense general election campaign and ultimately lost the popular vote. That doesn't always matter a lot when it comes to approval, but it certainly doesn't help. And I think there are some elements, I think people in his own party have suggested that, you know, that some of his Twitter activities don't appeal to everybody, things like that. So, you know, that's, he holds some controversial views that he's stuck to over the course of his presidency. So I think that's an important part of the background of the story. I don't think we can just carve out the State of the Union and discuss it separately from that context.
We're talking to Julia Azari from Marquette University, looking at the State of the Union address last night. Julia, immigration was something people were watching for. I think the president gave more detail about specific immigration plans than any other topic. I want to give a listen to the president talking about immigration, the DACA program, and referencing the program in a call for border security.
My duty and the sacred duty of every elected official in this chamber is to defend Americans, to protect their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream. Because Americans are dreamers too.
What did you make of that line in particular, Julia, before we get into the wider immigration debate?
Well, so in a little bit, I'm going to be teaching my American presidency class, and I'm going to give them some reactions from all across the spectrum. And so I've got one from the conservative end of the spectrum that said this was a terrific line, and that this was the best part of the address. I really hammered home his viewpoint, and then another viewpoint that says this is incredibly insulting. It's taking away the point that dreamers are trying to make about the threat that they feel. So I think that pretty much summarizes the two poles of the opinion about that line. On the one hand, Trump has had this really consistent America First kind of set of ideas that was a big part of his inauguration, and this speech reminded me much more of his inaugural address than of the address he gave to the joint session of Congress last year. So that's been, you know, is sort of not new to anybody. And yet at the same time, this has become a really forefront issue in a way that's fairly new to this era. Immigration is a central national point of debate. And those viewpoints are bothersome to a lot of people. And that stirs up a lot of controversy. And those will be key points, I think, used by opponents of the administration in the 2018 midterms, and then eventually looking ahead to 2020.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Madeline is with us in De Pere. Madeline, hi.
Hi. Yes, I heard a report that really alarmed me. And I heard today that the Dreamers, you know, everybody thinks the Dreamers are out picking strawberries. Well, they're going to college. Some of them have been to college. They have important jobs. And I heard that the Dreamers contribute over $40 billion a year toward Social Security and Medicare. And if they would suddenly leave, wouldn't that devastate Social Security and Medicare? And I'm talking as a elderly person.
Madeline, thanks for the call. Julia, I don't know if you have dug into that much detail on the Dreamers' impact on the economy, but in broad strokes anyway, what's at risk for the wider society if there's no deal reached on DACA?
Yeah, I think that the caller gets to an important issue. So I don't know. I am not an expert either in the labor market economics or really in immigration. So I don't know what the specifics. I think that it's unlikely that the impact of the Dreamers is so profound that if they were to leave, that it would collapse a major federal entitlement program. That seems unlikely. But what is likely, I think, and what is sort of the point of some of these debates about immigration that are not so much about who comes into the country or how, but about what to do with people who are already here, is that these folks are integrated into their communities. And so this is what I've heard from people who do have expertise in immigration, that these are folks who are sometimes they're married to U.S. citizens, their kids are U.S. citizens, and they're working jobs, and they're paying some taxes in different forms depending on their employment situation. And they're integrated into their communities, and so having them leave and taken from their communities would be, I think, disruptive. And I think that's something we can acknowledge, even though there's very strong feelings all across the ideological spectrum about immigration, is that when you propose to take people who are living here, and a large number of people, and have them leave, that has a kind of ripple effect on a broader community.
Thanks
and on the economy.
Thanks for the call, Madeline. We're talking to Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, looking at President Trump's first State of the Union address last night. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to the State of the Union address overall? Are there particular items within it that you liked or didn't like? Are there things that the president should have addressed but did not? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Julia Azari from Marquette University, looking at President Trump's State of the Union address last night. You can join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Did you like what you heard? Did you not? Did you avoid the speech altogether? What issues were you glad the president brought up? What did you like? What didn't you like in the speech? What was missing? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. One of the things some people saw missing, Julia, was talk about Russian interference in the U.S. elections and in other elections in Western Europe, for that matter, saying why didn't the president tackle those in his list of challenges facing the country? What are your thoughts?
So that's a really big one, and I know what I heard as I was listening to other public radio programs driving to work this morning. There clearly, there's a set of ideas that he didn't bring that up for the same reasons that people have suggested he's not enforcing the sanctions on Russia more harshly. So there's that interpretation. I think it's hard to know what he would have said that would have addressed his critics' concerns and made them feel better. He could have said anything, and I don't know that would have really meant that there was nothing going on behind the scenes. And for his supporters, who I think clearly were probably the more likely people to be watching the speech and who he was more trying to address, they don't really want to hear about that. One thing that seemed like it might be possible is that he would say more about how the investigation should end. We've seen enough of that. Nixon did a version of that in 1974, and we didn't really see that so much in so many words. So I honestly don't know what to make of it, or precisely what the speechwriters might have been thinking. But probably the smart strategy is when you have something like that you don't want to mention, and there's nothing you can say to win that issue, that downplaying it is a relatively low-risk strategy.
You mentioned earlier the infrastructure spending plan, something the president has talked about before, something that people see as maybe a bipartisan opportunity. Let's listen to a little of what he had to say.
Tonight, I'm calling on Congress to produce a bill that generates at least $1.5 trillion for the new infrastructure investment that our country so desperately needs. Every federal dollar should be leveraged by partnering with state and local governments and, where appropriate, tapping into private sector investment to permanently fix the infrastructure deficit. And we can do it.
Julia, what do you think? Is there room for cooperation in Congress on something like this?
I think there might have been last year. I think it's hard to imagine that going into a midterm. And I think the politics of that are going to be challenging. It's tempting to think that what the kinds of legislation that's really likely to happen is the kind where you can carve out a middle ground between the two parties and you can kind of get some people from each party who are excited about that legislation, or at least are sort of in favor of it. But I think that's going to be a really tricky one, because I can't think of a core constituency in the Republican Party for whom this is going to be a central issue. It's something a lot of people care about, but unless it has a core, I hate to say it, but unless it has a core set of interest groups that are really pushing for it, I don't see there being the political energy in Congress. Now, I could be wrong about this. If people turned around, Republicans and Democrats, and wrote letters and called their representatives in droves and put a lot of political pressure for a bill, then obviously the political situation would be different. But the kinds of things that languish are the kinds of things that most people think are a good idea, but for no one is it their main core passionate issue.
Let's go back to our callers now. Patrick is on the line in eastern Wisconsin. Patrick, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I didn't watch it. And today, talking to people I probably talked to about 8 or 10, I only found one person that did watch it, and they didn't watch it, they taped it. And I didn't watch it because I don't see that it has much real importance to me. The State of the Union is going away to the old party platform and the planks, and it had meaning in the past, but I can't see that there's much linkage between any of these proposals and reality.
Patrick, thanks for the call. I didn't watch it myself. I listened to it on the WPR app. I'll get a little plug in there. But Julia, do you think a lot of people think like Patrick that it's kind of archaic, not really worth watching?
I do think that. I mean, I don't have hard numbers in front of me. So I watched it and I live blogged it on 538. I'll do my plug. I knew a lot of people who weren't watching it. I heard a lot of people who weren't watching it. And that was the case, too, I think, a couple years ago. So I don't think it's totally driven by however people might feel about Trump. I think the caller's comparison to party platforms is quite astute. And I think that that's right, that these things aren't the sorts of core documents that day-to-day a lot of people see as being relevant for their lives. But on the other hand, again, these organized interests still really make a strong effort to get their issue included in the State of the Union, to get their issue included in the platform. So a lot of elite power politics are still happening around these documents that ordinary people are not necessarily really attuned to. And I think I don't know what the solution to that is or what to do moving forward, but I would encourage everybody to really think about that.
Patrick, thanks for that call. We're talking to Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, looking at the State of the Union address. Back to your calls. Colin is with us in Dubuque. Colin, hi.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, what I want to bring up is what Mr. Trump didn't bring up, which is anything relating to climate. All he brought up was this beautiful, clean-burning coal. That's fine. While the rest of the world, is worried about renewable resources. And even if he doesn't agree with it, why are we not, striving to be the leaders in, like, creating solar panels or turbines? And, we could lead the world in that, even if we don't want to use it here at home, or he doesn't want to use it here at home.
Colin, thanks for the call. Julia, mention of energy and fossil fuels in particular, not an environmental mention.
No, you did not hear that. So I want to take a step back and put this in context, which is to suggest that it did used to be that both the issues of the environment and that kind of relationship between the government and the scientific community used to be quite a bit more bipartisan than they are now, and now that's really changed. And again, going back to what are Trump's incentives to talk about these kinds of issues, Increasingly, the constituencies that he's responding to in the Republican Party are not ones that want to hear that message, and we see that reflected. And I think that that's, you know, it's concerning that there's not more more bipartisan effort to engage with these issues and come up with some solutions to the problems.
Colin, thanks for the call. Julia, as we start to wrap up, you mentioned earlier you saw commonalities, themes from President Trump's inaugural address where the phrase American carnage featured prominently and this first State of the Union. Can you talk about how you saw that tone carried through there?
Yeah, I was really struck by this by the end of the speech, that the thing that linked up the domestic portion of the speech and the foreign policy portion of the speech was this violence. And Trump talks fairly graphically and in detail about the violence that people have experienced in different ways. And so we had a number of crime victims. We talked about gang violence. We talked about terrorism. And we talked about the torture perpetrated by the North Korean government, and that this was many of the people who were highlighted with their stories. It was about violence, or in one case, it was a woman struggling with a drug addiction. So it was very, I thought these themes, it was interesting to me that people said this was an optimistic speech. Watching it in my living room, I came away with a very different kind of impression, that there were a lot of very dark themes that were underlying that weren't, you know, no one's going to write a line in the speech that says what ties us all together is the world is a cruel and violent place. But that was sort of how I felt at the end. So that was just kind of my reaction watching it from a rhetoric kind of perspective.
And briefly, Julia, you kind of touched on this earlier. Do you see this speech targeted more toward President Trump's already existing supporters than the country as a whole?
I think for sure most presidential rhetoric is often going to be targeted at their existing supporters rather than the country as a whole.
Julia, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Julia Azari is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. She joined us to look back at last night's State of the Union address.